My name is Mary Walshock. I'm Associate Vice Chancellor for Public Programs, and it is my pleasure on behalf of your hosts, three universities in San Diego, the University of California, San Diego, San Diego State University, and the University of San Diego, to invite you to listen to this wonderful presentation by Professor Yunus. We are all indebted to Dr. Yunus and the Grameen Organization for making this trip to San Diego and for sharing his valuable time and wisdom with all of us in this public forum. It seemed appropriate to the three organizers of this event that a community person who has been involved in issues that resonate with Dr. Yunus's values introduce him. The establishment of Grameen America, which he is going to talk about today, is about poverty in the United States, not just in the world. And our community leader who is going to introduce him has been involved in issues of poverty, diversity, and immigration her entire life. We all agreed that Deborah Zeke, a local business leader who founded Rancho La Puerta and the Golden Door Spas, and has been a community visionary and national force who is currently building a museum and learning center for new Americans at NTC here in San Diego, would provide the ideal introduction. Deborah's work and the work of the New Americans Museum is animated by the same sense of possibilities and challenges underlying the work of Dr. Yunus and the Grameen Bank. Thank you, Deborah, for agreeing to provide an introduction. And once again, on behalf of all our three universities, welcome to all of you.
I'm delighted to welcome to our community the most distinguished guest, an economist by profession and Nobel laureate, the first practitioner so honored. Our guest is a very special kind of economist, one who not only looked at the computer, books and papers piled on his desk, but looked out the window and saw the poor neighborhood close by his university. He puzzled at the theories and debates and dilemmas echoing in economic literature. But he did something more. He walked out of the university and into his neighborhood. He listened to what the people had to say about their hungry children, their never-ending poverty, a degree of poverty we fortunate Americans cannot even imagine. It was not a matter of economics, of working smarter. It was simple. You need money to make money. They, without collateral, had to pay usurious rates to the money lenders, and there was no hope that this would ever change. He had an idea, and from this simple idea, he created a micro-lending program that would change their world. He began with an initial investment of $27 out of his own pocket and an earnest commitment to the poor Bangladeshi women. Today, we celebrate the results. 7 million members strong, Grameen Bank. Just a year ago, Muhammad Yunus and a dozen women representing members of the Grameen Bank journeyed to Sweden to share the Nobel Prize. He and the women and the Grameen Bank caught the world's attention. They taught the world that credit collateralized, trustworthy friends and community could be an effective tool, a catalyst for true economic development. Today, he is here with us to talk about the principles underlining the Grameen Bank and how it is applicable to the challenges confronting new immigrants and persistent problems of poverty in the United States. As a person striving to build new awareness of the power of imagination to America's future, I could not be more pleased at this potential. Dr. Muhammad Yunus is an extraordinary visionary, leader who has much to teach us how to empower people who are powerless. He knows how to make things happen. He is here to lead the way. Now you have a very special treat. To begin this afternoon, we present a song, Here and Now, which you will long remember. Very special joy for me to be able to welcome to San Diego Dr. Muhammad Yunus.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I'll give you a little background how I got drawn into this. I'm not a banker, I'm just a teacher teaching economics. I did my PhD from Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee, in economics, and started teaching in Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, in Tennessee. I was enjoying my teaching, I always enjoyed teaching. In Bangladesh, at that time it was known as East Pakistan. There were two parts of Pakistan. One was known as West Pakistan, and another was known as East Pakistan. And there was 1,000 miles of India in between. when we enthusiastically became one country after the British left. But our relationship started souring as it went. And in 1971, we got into a war. And lots of people died. And a tremendous amount of devastation took place in East Pakistan. But at the end of 1971, East Pakistan became an independent country, named herself Bangladesh. And I was campaigning for the independence of Bangladesh within the United States because I was still teaching at MTSU. And went to many university campuses addressing the students to support our cause. When Bangladesh became independent, immediately I resigned from my job. I thought it's time to go back and be part of the new country. And when such liberation war takes place and it ends with the victory, you go through an euphoria, tremendous amount of euphoria. You did something that you always wanted and not now it happened. But in most cases, those euphoria turns into nightmares. And that's exactly what happened in our case. We thought Bangladesh now will move on and change the lives of the people. It didn't happen that way. Economy was sliding down very fast. We are faced with a famine in 1974. And people are dying of hunger. And when people die of hunger and you, a young economics teacher teaching elegant theories in the classroom, it doesn't make you feel good. Because all your brilliant theories don't seem to come to have any use to people who are dying. And it's a death you cannot explain because it's not a disease that you can fight and you can find cure for that. It's just not having a little bit of food to eat. And it's not 100 people dying or 1,000 people dying. It's hundreds and thousands of people dying. So in a situation like that, you have nothing but frustrations and agony. One way I tried to kind of lighten my frustration and agony by coming to the conclusion that I may not be useful as an economist, but I'm still a basic human being. I can just go out and stand next to another human being and see if there's anything I can do to another person, even for a day. If it helps him or her for a day, I feel a little bit better. So that's what I started doing, going outside the campus. This is a university campus which is right in the middle of the villages, so you don't have to look for village somewhere else. It's right there. You get out of the campus border and you are right in the village. And I started doing that, and I did a lot of little things that I could do and felt a little better, and I got to know people better, which I had no idea people live like that. I read in papers, I read in books, but not in a face-to-face way. So in a way, that university became my university. That village becomes my university, learning from the people. And one thing that gradually started drawing my attention was the harshness and ruthlessness of the moneylenders in that village. We read about moneylenders and we try to understand what this is all about. But you don't realize it until you come face to face with it. And you see how ruthless the system is. And I wanted to know a little bit more about it. And I wanted to find out how many people in the village go out and borrow money from the moneylenders in the same village. So I went around taking a student of mine with me for several days to do that. And when my list was complete, there were 42 names on that list. And the total money they borrowed was $27. I was in shock. Because as economics teacher, you are used to dealing with figures like millions of dollars and billions of dollars. You don't talk about pennies in economics class. Particularly when you talk about, at that time, something popular all over the world, 5-year national development plans. So here you go, the industrialization, this sector, that sector, how much money you have to invest. So the poverty disappears and people come out of poverty and so on. So that's the kind of routine as an economics teacher that I was used to, not talking about $27. And I looked at it and I realized that what a terrible problem it is, because it is this money lending is going on ever since money was introduced into the system, probably. It never disappeared. So I can see how entrenched the system is. But what thrilled me, that the problem may be difficult, but the solution is so simple. And the thought that came to my mind, that if I give this $27 from my pocket to all these 42 people, they can go and return this money to the moneylenders and they'll be free. Moneylenders can't touch them anymore. Another thought came to my mind after that. And I thought that was a brilliant idea. I thought that I should go to the bank located in the campus and ask them to lend the money to the poor people in the village. It's a very small amount of money. They'll be delighted. Instead of me becoming the angel, they will become the angel. So I'll even entice them. And with all my plans, I go to see the manager of the bank. His manager turns to fall from the sky. He said, he couldn't believe that I even said something like that. He said, no way. Bank cannot lend money to the poor people. Why? Because they are not creditworthy. So we went on a big debate. I said, they are the people who need the money and you don't want to give the money. You give money to the people who already have money. And that's the way banks are, he told me. As if it doesn't bother me at all. The more I try to draw his attention that the need of these people is so drastic, a little money will make such a big difference in their lives, he remains totally unmoved. He advised me, he said, hey, I can't do anything about this. This is the bank's rule. I cannot change rules. You go and see the senior officials in banking hierarchy. Talk to them. See if they can find a way to come up with some solution. I took his word and went around meeting all those top bankers to see if they can have a solution for me. Everybody answered the same way. Bank cannot lend money to the poor people. Banks are not for the poor people. I kept telling them that this is a very unjust system. I said, what can you do? That's the way we are. And finally, I came up with an idea again. Discussing with them, I have learned something about their rules, and I use that. I said, why don't you accept me as a guarantor? That way you save your rules, and I get the money. This time I spoke their language, So they couldn't really throw me away. So it took another 2 months. Finally, they agreed to accept me as a guarantor. But not because they were persuaded my arguments. Because they thought the whole thing will fail anyway. So this would be a very cheap way to get rid of him. Give him some money and then this thing, whole thing will disappear. He has to pay from his own pocket. Then he will realize that it's no good. I was very enthusiastic. I had no idea how this is going to happen, but I felt good that finally I opened the door of the bank. When the bank manager gave the money with me signing all the papers, he gave me the best advice he could give. He said, say goodbye to your money. You're not going to see them anymore. I said, I have no idea. I'll try. I hope it will work, but I cannot guarantee it. So I started and came up again little ideas to make it easy for people to pay back so that they feel like paying back rather than stay away from paying back. It worked. And I got very excited. And with all my excitement, I tell the bank manager, look, it works. Every penny came back. He was totally unimpressed. He said, well, you did it only one village. In one village, a university professor can show all kinds of miracles. But if you can't do it in two villages, it won't work. You have been just lucky or you worked so hard. So I became very enthusiastic to do it in two villages. And I did it in two villages, three villages, continued. But the bank manager doesn't change his mind. And this was a big lesson for me. And that lesson stays with me all the time. How you struggle against the mindsets of people. Once the mind is made, it's extremely difficult to undo it. The manager sees this very clearly that every penny gets paid back in every round. But still he hides behind or he stays behind his notion, his idea. It won't work. Banking cannot be wrong. He has to be wrong. So he's waiting for the whole thing to collapse. And all my rest of my life that I worked with this, it is nothing but a struggle against mindsets. And that struggle has not ended yet. After all these years, after all those expansions and reaching out to so many millions, still, you go to the bankers, conventional banks. They would not say, oh, we should do it. This is a great idea. Let's all do this. That's not how it happens. And on mindset, I particularly mention one thing. In a way, our education system is also responsible in creating that mindset. Because when we go through our education system, gradually we are creating those ideas. At that time we thought this is not as strong as it is, but as we come out of those universities and educational institutions, we hold to those ideas and things that were taught in our classroom so strongly. Nobody can kind of shake us from them. Not only we go to the schools to learn, in a way we become the mini version of our professors. The way they think, the way they argue, the way they promote their ideas. And for the rest of our life, we repeat the same thing, continue that. So this is one aspect of education. We have to keep on thinking how to keep individual mind free at the same time we bring education, learning from students without converting them into mini version of the professors. What I did, those are small loans that I gave for the purpose of creating income generating opportunity. That's all I was trying to do. So that they can pay back the money, at the same time move up the economic ladder. And one thing I should mention right at the beginning, because this question comes up again and again, why do you have so many women in your work? And this happened right at the beginning. When I was criticizing the banking system, I was always telling the banking system is wrong, banking system is unjust, because it excludes the poor people. And then I added one more thing to that argument. I said banking system is again unjust and wrong because it excludes women from its system. The bankers in Bangladesh didn't like that. They tried to say, no, we do. We are open, women can borrow from us. I said, but your statistics do not tell us that story. I challenged them. I said, even if you can show me, if you can show me even 1% of your borrowers happen to be women, I will not raise this issue anymore. You are good guys. Okay. Of course, there is no 1%. So when I began, I wanted to make sure half the borrowers in my program are women. Because I spoke so strongly about this issue, so I wanted to make sure it is reflected in my own work. So here I am, sticking to my decision. I go to the women and ask them to think of taking some money and use it for making money. And all I hear in every case, women saying, no, no, don't give it to me. I don't have any idea what to do with money. Some saying, I never touched money in my life. It's a very scary thing. I don't want to get involved with it. Give it to my husband. He's the one who handles money. So here I am trying to make it 50%. And wherever I go, they said, no, no, not me. And my students who were working with me, they were very disappointed. They said, look, this is not going to work. Why don't we just go ahead, whoever is willing to take money, and so that we can move on, rather than wait for these women to take money. And we can't get these women to make money because they said they don't know anything. Why are you insisting on them? I kept telling them, have patience. When a woman says, no, I cannot take money, I have no idea, it is not her voice. It is the voice of the fear that history has created around her, year after year, century, hundreds of years. And she is totally covered by those fears. So unless we have patience and continue to encourage or try to encourage them and take their fears layer by layer, and then finally hope that they will come out of the fear and looking at it more transparently, and someone will say, yes, let me give it a try. We should wait for that day, but keep on working. So they were patient, but it took us 6 years of our work to come to that 50-50 level. And we were very happy that finally we made it. Everybody said it cannot be done. We did it. And then as we go on now carrying on the work, because now women are coming, seeing other women taking, women gets encouraged, they would, more women want to come. So we are feeling happy about it. But what we noticed again, that money went to the family through women, brought so much more benefit to the family than the same amount of money going to the family through men. So case after case, we see the same result. The impact in the family is much more if we enter the family through women. Then we started asking ourselves, what is so good about 50-50? So at one point we took the bold decision, let's forget about 50-50, let's concentrate on women, because it makes so much more sense. And that's what we did. As a result, we moved from 50 to 60, 70, and so on. Today we have 7.5 million borrowers in Grameen Bank in Bangladesh. And 97% are women. And the bank... And the bank is owned by the borrowers. We've designed the bank in such a way, the borrowers should become the owners of the bank. So always, they, no matter how many they come in, they become the owners of the bank. So we have 7.5 million borrowers. And so many are the shareholders. They are the owners of the bank. So that way it is an interesting bank. It works for the poor women. It's owned by the poor women. And all the policies are decided by these poor women because they sit in the board. Because there was owner, they are the one who sit in the board. When the Nobel Peace Prize was announced last year, in October, everybody in Bangladesh was very happy. It's one explosion of happiness that something happened to our country. And while we are going through this jubilations in the country, I get a telephone call from Oslo. When you are coming to Oslo to receive the prize, who would be receiving the prize that is given to the bank, Grameen Bank? Because the prize is divided between me and the bank. Half is for me and half is for the bank. So they assume that the first half that comes to me, I'll receive it. And the other half from the bank, who will receive it? So I immediately said, of course, the owners of the bank should receive it. The person who was asking the question, he said, who are the owners? I said, 7.5 million borrowers of Grameen Bank. For a few seconds, he kept quiet. And I realize now why he was silent. Because Norway has only 4.5 million people. So sensing his worries, I said, no, not everybody will come. We'd bring only the 9 of them who are elected to be the board members. They are the directors of the bank. So we'll bring all the 9. And among the 9, one of them will stand up and receive the prize. And that's how it was. It happened, and it was a fantastic moment for the whole country and for the whole world, that a poor woman from Bangladeshi village goes to Oslo, stands up, and receives the Nobel Prize. Grameen Bank is also interesting because it doesn't take any money from anybody. It doesn't take money from the government. It doesn't take money from the borrower, for the donors. Or it doesn't borrow from anybody. It just generates the money inside. It takes deposits from people and lends the same money to the poor people in the locality. And that's how it runs. Not only Grameen Bank as a whole doesn't need money from outside, Each branch that we built, we have now 2,500 branches all over Bangladesh, and more branches are added as we go along. Each branch has to be self-sufficient with their own money. When we add a new branch, we send a branch manager with his staff. We give the instruction to the branch manager where to open the branch. We give the address of the location where his branch will be located. So he gets the address, and we tell him, that's all you get. You don't get any money from us. You go there and start a Grameen Bank. First, you mobilize the deposits from the people around the place. And then as you receive deposits, you start lending money to the poor people in that area, poor women in that area. And that's exactly what he does. He has no problem. We have never heard any manager saying, sorry, I don't have any money here. You have to give us money, so move. Money gathering deposits was never a problem. And the next condition that we give to him, that not only we don't give you any money, you have one more task to perform. Within maximum of 12 months, you have to bring the branch to the break-even point, meaning you should be covering all your cost from your revenue. And most of the branches fulfill that condition too. Those branches which cannot fulfill it in 12 months, they may take one extra month or two extra months. But that's about the limit within which you have to bring it to profit-making level. When they make profit, they are supposed to send it to the head office. That's the only interest we have. You send us the money that you make so that we can reimburse this money to the shareholders. As shareholders, they can get back the dividend of the, from the profit the bank makes. So it's a self-contained financial institution. And we always have more in deposits than the loan you give out. Right now we have 50% or 53% more in deposits than the loan that we give out. Because we want to always keep a good cushion of resources, because Bangladesh is a disaster-prone country. You read about Bangladesh mostly about the floods and so on. So we have recurrent flood. In many floods, people lose everything. So we have to replenish their resources by giving them fresh loans so that they can get started and get on back on their feet quickly. We need money. So we want to always be ready with that money, so that in times of crisis, we don't have to run around going to get all this money, and it's a huge amount of money. And our repayment rate has been always very high. And people wonder how this is possible, because again, in the mindset of the banking, it doesn't make sense. We don't have any collateral. We don't have any guarantee from anybody. We don't have any legal instrument. We have no lawyers around us. Sorry, lawyers. It works. It's almost kind of strange where you have all these things, the collateral, the lawyers, and all kinds of securities that you want to build up. So difficult to get your money back. But we run a banking system where nothing exists. Still it works. And it's not only in Bangladesh. Today it is spread everywhere, including Santiago. In Santiago also there is microcredit program, and it works beautifully. And exactly the same way it works in Bangladesh or any other country. So it's nothing special about Bangladesh or Grameen Bank. It's the system works under all circumstances. So if you look at Grameen Bank, you wonder how this, all these rules that we created with no collateral, no guarantee, but still money comes back. How do you invent these rules, which you call Grameen Bank methodology? I tried to answer that question as best as I could, but still people don't get it. So I say it in another way. I say, look, when we need a rule to address a particular problem in our work, we just look at the conventional banks. What do they do in such circumstances? Once we learn about it, we just reverse it. And we got Grameen Bank. So in a way, Grameen Bank is a complete reversal of that system. Conventional banks went to the rich. We went to the poor. Conventional banks in country like Bangladesh and many other went to the men. We went to women. Conventional bank concentrated in the urban areas. We went to the rural areas. Grameen Bank still doesn't work in the urban areas. It works only in the rural areas, concentrating in the rural areas. Basic principle of conventional bank is the more you have, the more you can get. We reversed it. We said less you have, more attractive you are. If you have absolutely nothing, you get the highest priority. And it works. We are always looking for the one, the poorest one. We have our checklist for our staff. Who should qualify to join Grameen Bank? If the roof is leaky, then she qualifies, fulfills the first condition. If the family doesn't have anything to sleep on, they all sleep on the floor, then another condition fulfilled. If there's only one room, you fulfill another condition. So you go down the line to this. If there's no furniture whatsoever inside the room, then you have fulfilled another condition. And then you talk to the woman about Grameen Bank and explain what it does. And she says, no, I don't need money. We train our staff and tell them she's the one we are looking for. In conventional banks, you have to go and explain what a genius you are in your business. You know everything, ins and outs of your business, and your business plan is brilliant. It's absolutely fail-proof in order to draw them into discussion so that they pay serious attention. We deal with borrowers who say, no, I don't know anything. I don't need any money. And our job is to build confidence in it. So this is another reversal. So you go down the line, you see one after another. When I say it's the reverse image, there's quite a bit of truth in it. So we get stuck with one kind of system, with nothing can work without that. This is a proof that it can do absolute opposite way too, and does better. I was an economics teacher. I was never a banker. I never intended to be a banker. But a strange turn of the fate, I became a banker. And people ask me, what is the best thing that happened to you in really creating this bank? What was it special? I said, the most important thing I feel that I knew nothing about banking. That way I could create this. If I was trained as a banker, it would be impossible to do things that I do now. Because the mind, you will say, no, 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 you're not supposed to do that. That's not banking. But luckily, I didn't feel that way because I didn't know anything about it. And it could be done. So this is a good message for young people in the university. Sometimes not knowing is a blessing. You can think fresh, absolutely from the down, you can work it out from there. So this is the way it works out for Grameen Bank. Right from the beginning, we paid a lot of attention to the children of Grameen Bank. This became a kind of an obsession with us. Because these are all illiterate people in Grameen Bank. All those 7.5 million borrowers we're talking about, their families are illiterate families. Husband doesn't read and write, woman doesn't read and write, or nobody else reads and writes. So our thought was, why don't we encourage these children of these families to go to school? There is something called 16 decisions in Grameen Bank. Some of you who follow closely Grameen Bank, you'll see one of the 16 decisions is, we shall send our children to school and help them stay in school. And we took advantage of the decision and encouraged these borrowers that why don't we send our children to school. And we did it very consistently, persistently, and gradually we succeeded. Finally, we saw that all the children of Grameen families are in school. Then we noticed some of these children not only went to school, they started coming at the top of the classes. That was quite a thrilling experience for us, because someone who has no background whatsoever, who never gets any assistance in the homework or anything because family doesn't understand what the kids are doing, they are being in the top of the class. So we wanted to celebrate that. The one idea we thought would be good celebration is to give them scholarships. And we make a ceremony in the village, officially announce that she has received a scholarship because she has performed so well in her class for this and so on. It encourages other kids and the families that they are accomplishing something. It's not just going to school, but something very, very unusual. Right now we give more than 30,000 students scholarships. So they are not just few, there's a lot of them. And as we grow, more and more children are coming into that level. And we encourage them and we give them the scholarship to take some money home every month. That here it is, that you have done something, bank recognizes you. Then another thing we noticed, about 12 years back, that some of the students are in higher education who came to the university. Then we realized how many of them couldn't make it to the university because their parents couldn't support them. And we immediately decided that we'll give a student loan. Entire education for them will be financed by Grameen Bank. And we introduced it. Right now we have over 18,000 students in medical schools, in engineering schools, in universities. Two of them just finished their PhDs. It's wonderful to see coming from totally illiterate families moving into another world completely. And when I go to universities like today I am, I always suggest, why don't you offer scholarships to the Grameen Bank children to come and study here in your campus? It does two things. One, to show that being poor doesn't make you poor quality. There's nothing. All human beings are born with unlimited potentials. Their birthplace has nothing to do with their potentials. Child born in the street has the same potential as the child born in the palace. But it's the society which decides who should be where. And the street child who is born in the street will become a street kid and get involved with all kinds of problems that we all know about, familiar about. And the one born in the palace will be the prince or the princess and be treated as such. But it has nothing to do with the capacity one has. So the question is, why do we have poor people? If they all have their own ability and smartness and so on, what makes them poor? Poverty is not created by the poor people. Poverty is created by the system. System that we all together built. The institutions that we built. The concepts that we have designed. Theories that we have constructed. Which made our mindsets. That created the poverty. Otherwise, why should bank close the door to a huge, big number of the world population? Almost 2/3 of the world population are not eligible to do business with banks, business with people. So, and we look at other things, not only banks, you look institution by institution, you see the biases included in them because of the mindsets that we have. And I talk about the concept, one concept that immediately comes to my attention, I bring it out again and again, is the concept of business. Only concept of business which is included into the economic theory is the business to make money. Profit maximization is the mission of business. And my point is, human being is much bigger than just relegated to one thing, just make money. Making money is an important aspect of human being, but that is not the whole human being. So theoreticians just took a part of human being and built the entire theory, ignoring the other parts of human being. Human beings are also caring human beings. The same person has a feeling to touch other people's lives. So when he or she wants to do that, economic theory tells them, step outside of economics, be a philanthropist, do some charity work, and come back and make money. Because you have no other role within business. I said that is not quite justified. So I'm suggesting, why don't we enlarge the concept? At least there are two concepts of business. One, to make money, and another, to do good. A business to good to people, do good to people. That's a legitimate business too. This is a non-loss, non-dividend company. You don't get any dividend, but with a social objective. You are trying to achieve an objective. And you don't have to pour all your money into it. It's up to you. You can put all your money into profit-making businesses, but you must have a choice because this is part of human being. So if you can create social, we call it social business. If you can create social business, then we can address many of the issues that we face today. Poverty, global warming, or good quality drinking water, healthcare services for the poor people, or name it. It could be a social business where we do it not for making personal money, but to solve the problem. Because it is the creativity of human minds which will solve the problem. We can address that through social business. We created several social businesses in Bangladesh. One of them is very interesting, I should quickly mention that. We created a joint venture company with Danone. Danone is the food company, which the water company and the yogurt company. You know, Danone yogurt, everybody likes. So this is called Grameen Danone Company in Bangladesh. I met the chairman of Danone in a chance meeting. And we were discussing, and I suggested to him, why don't we create a Grameen Danone company in Bangladesh? He said, to do what? I said, to produce yogurt. You said your yogurt is very delicious. I said, for a special purpose. We have a lot of malnourished children in Bangladesh. Lots of them. Millions of them. We can put all the micronutrients which is missing in the children into the yogurt. Vitamin, iron, zinc, iodine, everything that is missing in the proportion that scientists tell us how it is missing, and then sell it to them. At a price, they buy the snacks, cheap snacks they buy in the villages, and they will eat the yogurt and regain those micronutrients and be healthy. He said, I agree. He shook hands and he said, I agree. I said, I have not finished yet. I said, it will be a social business. He says, what is a social business? I explained to him, in this business, social business, you can invest, but you cannot take any dividend. You can take all your investment back, recoup all your money, but after you have taken back the last penny, it stops. Company continues to earn profit, but it's not your profit. It's company's profit. Company continues to expand and reach out to more children because it is driven by the social objective. He again shook hands. He said, I agree. This time I thought he doesn't understand my English. But later on I exchanged emails explaining everything. I said, please confirm if we understand each other. He gladly sent me back. He said, I understood every word of it. Let's go ahead and do it. And we created that company. We are selling that yogurt now in Bangladesh, fortified yogurt with all the iron, zinc, and everything that is missing, micronutrients. So that is an example of social business. We have now in business school, we train MBAs, young people to be trained to go out, join the profit-making companies to make more profit. That's the job they're trained for. So we'll be, parallelly, we'll be needing another MBA. We'll call it social MBA. They will be trained how to run companies to do good to people, how to prepare their business plan, how to reduce the cost so that they can reach out to more people, and how to recover the money and run it more efficiently, most efficiently possible, so that it can reach out to more and more people and solve the problems at hand. And also we'll need a separate stock market. Because this is stock market is about making money. So we need another social stock market. Where we'll be listing all the social businesses. Grameen Danone, Eye Care Hospital, and such many, many, many hundreds and thousands of companies that we'll all build will be all listed there. Anybody who would like to say, I like this idea. They are bringing water to the neighborhood that I lived. It's terrible. They don't have water. So this company is bringing beautiful drinking water for them, and they're all delighted that they got over this problem. I would like to invest my money there. And you'll be an investor. You'll be owner of that company. And you feel good that now they don't suffer from the diseases they used to suffer. So this is an opportunity to think, see how far we can take it. I'll stop here. Thank you very much. Thank you.